Why is it so hard to say no? I know. You want to help people. You want to be nice. You want to show that you can take on everything and make it all work. But winning doesn't need you to do any of those things. Winning needs you to win. I've had clients make a no list of things they are not going to do, a non-negotiable reminder of things that aren't a priority. Keep it in your phone, on your desk, tape it to the mirror, the refrigerator, and use it. Just making the list will give you a fresh perspective on what really matters and what's just cluttering up your schedule and your life. Stop adding. Start deleting. Winning demands total focus. Everything and everyone doesn't merit equal time and attention. If you're going to have more time for what you want, you're going to have less time for the friends who need to fill you in on their daily life dramas, the group texts with 30 people who think it's their job to entertain the group all day, the colleagues who love to have meetings that resolve nothing. It's important, they say. Not to me, you think. Delete. Is it easier to climb a mountain with a weighted vest and a full pack, or with just the essentials? Instead of giving yourself more to do, start getting rid of everything that's dragging you down, everything you're doing to meet other people's expectations and demands. Those things have to go. Handle that, and you already have more time for the meaningful, important elements in your life: family, kids, health, yourself. You want an exercise on how to delete what you don't need? Work with this. Everyone has this one muscle that's essential to focusing, prioritizing, and ultimately winning. You can't see it. You can't show it off under your clothes. It's internal. The IDGAF muscle. The medically correct term is the I don't give a fuck muscle. It's stronger in some people than in others, and it gets stronger the more you use it. This is the muscle you flex when you need to make critical decisions about your life and your priorities, when others are telling you what to do, judging your decisions, and distracting you from your mission. You can also use it on yourself when your fears and doubts are whispering or screaming that you're not good enough and you don't know what you're doing. I hear you. Flex, and I don't give a fuck. But you can't just say it. You have to take real action based on a real decision. The first few times you use your IDGAF muscle, it may feel weak and sore and easily fatigued, as with any muscle you don't use often enough. But when you use it regularly and train it appropriately, it becomes strong, fast, and responsive. And that elevates your ability to separate from the things and people you need to move away from. This muscle should never be used in anger or to make an emotional decision. This is about making a decision you've wanted to make for a long time, a decision you knew was right, but for whatever reason, you didn't take action. You can use this muscle in almost every area of your life, but it's an especially powerful tool in the area of balance. This is the muscle that gives you freedom. I won't be at this event. I have another commitment. That doesn't work for me. Not doing it. The IDGAF muscle is the power behind the delete button. Stop spending time you don't have, on people you don't like, doing things you don't want to do. What do you want? More time to work? More focus on your goals? More time in your relationship? More time to yourself? Figure it out and make a decision. Otherwise, you won't be happy in anything. And when you do make that decision, stop apologizing for it. If you need to acknowledge the difficulty of the choice you made, do it. Once. After that, every apology you make weakens your confidence and belief that you made the right choice. If you truly DGAF, then don't. I know there are those who can't buy into this. Oh, if only it was that easy. It is that easy when you know what you want and what you don't want. If you want to win, if you want success, I mean really want it, not just kinda sorta want it if things work out, you'll know for sure what you do not GAF about and what to delete. That's how you create balance that leads to success. Picture a scale. On one side, you have winning. That's it. All your dreams and goals and ambitions, they all go on that one side. On the other side, everything else. Family, friends, entertainment, vacations, commitments, obligations, whatever else is in your life. If you're reading this book, I'll assume the winning side of the scale probably carries more weight than the other side. But maybe you feel you need more balance, so you start messing with that scale, adding and subtracting from both sides. Work a little less. Visit your in-laws more. Stop checking emails on weekends. Start hanging out with your friends. Invest less money on your business. Spend more on the new car. Keep tinkering with that combination until you finally achieve perfect balance. Everything is even and equal. Congratulations. Now look at the result. What's the number on a perfectly balanced scale? Zero. You want zero happiness? You want zero success? You want zero results? You want zero achievement? You gave everything equal weight and balanced yourself right out of the race. If you want to excel at anything, you can't live in a state of total balance. Winning needs to dominate that scale until its side dips as low as it can go under the weight of your commitment. It can't completely collapse under the weight like a seesaw when one kid jumps off too fast and the other side comes crashing down, but it has to withstand as much as you can take, maybe a little more. It's your responsibility to remain in charge of that scale, so you're controlling it and it's not controlling you. When it gets too heavy, when you need to add a little more to the other side to lift you back up, you decide what's being added. No one else gets to decide that for you. Now you're starting to create balance for yourself. Stop depriving yourself of what you need to perform at the highest level. You need to be able to focus. You need sleep. You need to eat well. You need to stay healthy. Stop feeling guilty about taking care of yourself. It's essential if you're going to go the distance, and it's the best way to take care of everyone else who's relying on you. Believe me, I understand the conflict. No one wants to lose a relationship or hurt the family or damage friendships. But guaranteed, if you're chasing a dream or working tirelessly toward a goal, it's costing you something in your personal life. And if it isn't, you're probably not fully committed to those dreams and goals. That's for you to decide. But I don't know too many high achievers who haven't struggled with relationships. I don't care what they show on their social media or the family holiday card. I know too many successful people who constantly flaunt a perfectly balanced family life when the complete opposite is true. Those who brag about balance the most usually have the least. It's a show driven by guilt and regret. Don't fall for it. Believe what you know, not what you're allowed to see. At some point, there's going to be a disconnect between the pursuit of winning and giving energy to everything else around you. Others will say, "You're a million miles away." You'll think to yourself, "Only a million?" And then you'll realize you're exactly where you need to be. I watch my clients go through this every day, every season, every year. They miss birthdays, holidays, Mother's Day, Father's Day, graduations, weddings, Christmas. If you're an NBA superstar, you're rarely home for Christmas. Most people shrug and say they get paid plenty to do that. Yes, they do. Doesn't make it any easier when you're not there to play Santa for your kids or watch them open presents, or when you're missing the birth of your child because you're in another city competing for a championship. Living without balance means asking others in your life to understand, support, and wait. It takes a strong and confident person to stand up with you while you chase your dreams and put everything else in your life on hold. Someone who believes in you and what you're doing and understands that a win for you is a win for everyone in your circle. It takes someone as fucked up as you are. Great partners share your obsession and commitment. They don't think you're crazy. They know you're crazy, and that's what they love about you. You tell them your plans, and even if they don't completely understand where you're headed, they know you know exactly where you're headed. The only question they'll ask is, "You want me to drive?" If you can find that person, consider yourself fortunate. Your greatest partnerships, relationships, marriages, friendships will be with people who share your craziness for the end result. That's why I work so well with my clients. I'm as obsessed and fucked up as they are about winning. If you need partnership and support, ask for it. Don't just assume you're entitled to it, and keep those people alongside you, not behind you in the background. If they're important to you, let them be important. They can't feel as if it's all about you, and they're stuck in your dreams with nothing for themselves. They have their own dreams, and if you're not willing to support their aspirations, they probably won't stick around to support yours. Everyone has a responsibility to keep creating wins that benefit the partnership. Your respective ambitions don't have to intersect. You don't have to love what the other is doing. It doesn't mean working in the same business or even doing the same job. It means being aligned with what each of you needs to do, with total mutual respect and support. Without that, it's a broken partnership. Your partner's role is as important as yours, and if you want to keep him or her happy in that role, you need to be realistic about what's ahead. If you say you need a month to handle your business, handle it in a month. If you need 5 years, admit it's going to take 5 years. Don't ask for a couple of months and then still be absent, physically and or mentally, 10 years later. Be honest. This is going to be hard. It might not be pleasant. I'm doing this for us, and I appreciate what it will cost you. Stick with me. It will be worth it. Then make sure it's actually worth it. When you're present, be present. Put the phone down. Close the laptop. Don't just carve out time for the people in your life. Invest in that time. Give something back to those who have given to you. Your race isn't over, and you still need them. Make it worth their time to continue investing in that. Balance is an unforgiving tug of war, with winning on the other side. The flag is in the middle, right where balance lives. It's not here or there, it's not winning or losing. Dead center. Average. If you compete hard enough, you can pull winning over to your side. If you lose, winning drags you into the mud. Your objective is to fight like hell with everything you have, capture winning, and win the war. Ready? You manage to pull winning a little closer to you, and as soon as that flag moves off center, balance weakens. Good start, but you're not there yet. You dig in deeper and realize you're being pulled in the other direction, not by winning, but by other obligations. Got to cut them loose. Now you can pull harder, with more determination. You want this so badly, but you're distracted by other things and realize that for now, you have to block out everything but this competition. Total focus. Balance is completely gone, and now your focus gets sharper. Your anger gets stronger. Your muscles are burning. The skin is tearing off your hands. You can't breathe. More. Harder. Another step, pulling until your arms are trembling. It's just you and winning now. One more step. Almost there. And winning takes a giant leap backward, laughing, and yanks you back to where you started. Flag back to the middle, balance restored. Yet you can't let go. You cannot let go. You can't lose. You've come so far and sacrificed so much. You don't even realize how filthy you are. You're oblivious to the mud on your shoes, the bleeding blisters on your hands. You simply don't care, and you won't stop until you win, or winning makes you quit. And you're not going to quit. Then you look around and realize, no baggage, no distractions. It was just you, fighting for yourself and everyone you care about, fighting for everything. For that time, you're not thinking about anything else. You're 100% invested in what you're doing, and everything else can wait. There is no balance here. You pick up that rope again. You get a towel and wipe the blood off your hands and make sure winning sees it, that it's aphrodisiac. And then you keep going. The tug of war with winning continues. Or you can stay in the middle, perfectly balanced, and walk away. Back to safety, back to neutral. Not here or there, not forward or back, not up or down. You're not alone anymore because everyone else is in the middle with you, where no decisions or commitments are made, and you can stay average forever. It's nice. It's calm. But it sure as hell ain't winning. This is your battle, your race to greatness. How you achieve it, and whether you achieve it, relies solely on your selfish ability to prioritize without regret.
When we started working on this chapter, you had to convince me that being selfish was one of the most powerful traits a person can have. And I thought to myself, and I think I said to you, that if you asked 100 people what they thought about being selfish, 99.9% would not think that was a good thing. But by the time we finished, you had me completely convinced, as will everyone who listens to this chapter, that being selfish is one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself. And there's nothing wrong with it at all, except it just has a bad reputation. How did you come to that conclusion, and how did you manage to convince me and everyone else who hears this now?
Well, it's funny. If I would have talked to those 100 people before you talked to them, their answer would have been different. Why is selfish a bad thing? Why is taking care of yourself a bad thing? Why is separating yourself from others a bad thing? Why is investing in yourself a bad thing? Aren't all those things selfish? Because you're doing them for yourself? To stay in the race? To get back in the race? To win in the race? This is an unforgiving race. It's not a forgiving race. Winning requires you to be selfish. We're all selfish. We just like to put softer words around it. And there's nothing soft about this race. There's nothing soft about winning. If you don't invest in yourself, you don't trust yourself, you don't separate yourself from others, you will never finish this race.
Well, this chapter made me proud to be selfish, and I hope that our listeners can take this part of the ride with us and arrive at the same conclusion. Here we go.
Number one, winning is selfish.
At the start of the Bulls' last dance season, Scottie Pippen announced he'd be having ankle surgery to repair a ruptured tendon. Scottie was my client at the time, and we'd discussed whether he should have the surgery during the summer before that 97-98 season so he could be ready to play when the season opened. But Scottie opted to wait, in part because he didn't want to deal with it over the summer, and also because he was unhappy with his contract, which made him the sixth highest player on the Bulls and 122nd highest paid in the league that season. Against the advice of his own agents, as well as Bulls owner Jerry Reinsdorf, Scottie had agreed to a contract extension that was well below his value because he wanted the security of a long-term deal. And now he was unhappy about it. He figured they weren't paying him enough to rush back. If you watched The Last Dance, you may recall that the team had already been told 97-98 would be the end of their run. Coach Phil Jackson wouldn't be asked to return, essentially because of a rift between him and GM Jerry Krause, and because some of the players, including Scottie, wouldn't be re-signed. So the Bulls' second greatest player decided to have the surgery at the start of the season and miss the first 35 games. In one of the more controversial moments of The Last Dance, Michael referred to teammate Scottie Pippen as selfish. Scottie was wrong in that scenario, Jordan said. He could have got his surgery done as soon as the previous season was over and been ready for the next season. What Scottie was trying to do was try to force management to change his contract. Jerry wasn't going to do that. So now I got to start the season knowing that Scottie wasn't going to be around. I felt like Scottie was being selfish, worrying about himself as opposed to what his word was to the organization as well as to the team. But not all of their teammates felt that way. Everyone respected Scottie so much, said Steve Kerr. We felt his frustration. He probably should have been the second highest paid guy in the NBA. So we all felt for him. Nobody resented him for having that surgery. We all understood. Let's give him his space, and he's going to be there for the second stretch of the season for us. The fallout from that episode was immediate. Some felt Scotty had been selfish for putting his needs ahead of the team. But many felt Michael was selfish for blasting a teammate who'd been by his side all the way and whom he had called the greatest teammate I ever had. You tell me, selfish? Both? Neither? I don't want you to answer yet. Listen a little further and we'll come back to it. Start here. What's your definition of selfish? I'll give you a few options, and you can add your own. Egocentric, narcissistic, self-centered, self-absorbed, vain, conceited, asshole. If you've been called any or all of those things, which is likely if you're working on the balance issue we just discussed, it probably wasn't meant as a compliment, and you were probably offended. Winning would like you to just say, thank you, and keep on doing whatever you were doing. The fact is, winning requires selfishness. Winners don't care what you think. They know how to say no and feel good about it. They have no problem ending a business meeting after 90 seconds because they've heard enough. They don't pretend to like an idea just to make others feel good. They never commit to anything unless they see a benefit to themselves or their goals. Their time and agenda is their top priority, and they don't reach out to others unless they need to, which they rarely do. Selfish? Probably. Effective? They let their results speak for themselves. Winners don't need to be liked. They just need those results, and if they achieve them, they don't regret being what you consider selfish. Which leads me back to Scotty. Did I agree with his decision? I would have preferred he'd been ready to start the season with the rest of the team. But he did what he felt was right for himself. He knew the ramifications of his actions. He knew MJ would be unhappy with him, and he was willing to accept that. Selfishness requires you to stand by your choices and be courageous about the backlash. And when he returned to the team, we made sure he was ready to play. He faced his teammates, and they all got back to work. He started every game for the rest of the season, averaging 37.5 minutes and 19.1 points per game. End result, the sixth ring. As for MJ, there was no way he was going to pretend to be fine with Scotty's decision. If Michael thinks you're wrong, he has no problem holding you accountable. But he knew what ultimately mattered, and he never failed to credit Scotty with much of his own success. The first person he mentioned in his Hall of Fame speech? You never just saw me, he said. You saw Scottie Pippen. Scottie knew he'd be judged for his decision. MJ knew he'd be judged for his response. Neither one cared. When The Last Dance was released, and people got to see the true nature of MJ's relationships with teammates and other players around the league, such as in his own comments about Scottie, many were quick to point out how harsh and abusive he could be, sometimes good-naturedly, sometimes not. Of course, many of the players pointing out the harshness had been on the receiving end. But many others were critical of the way MJ pressured those who didn't play up to his standards, and how he made it clear there was only one way to play with him, his way. The way that had earned six championships. Results matter. You might be listening to this and thinking, that's just not me. Maybe not. But I'd be willing to wager, if you really look deeper, you'll see the things you do for yourself, maybe without even thinking about it, that others might consider selfish. It's in all of us. When you truly want the end result, those things are no longer a choice. They're a necessity. I know many psychologists and experts talk about the positive benefits of being supportive and positive and tolerant as opposed to being tough, strict, harsh, or critical. If that softer approach has worked for you, I mean with measurable results, not just as something that makes you the popular team leader, then keep doing what you're doing. Michael knew one way, and it worked. Not just for himself, but for everyone else around him. If that made him selfish, he'd gladly show you his six rings and say, "You're welcome." Why is it so wrong to be considered selfish? The word self literally relates to your identity, your individuality. Self defines who you are. There are books, songs, t-shirts, posters, and 4 billion Facebook posts telling you to love yourself, find yourself, take care of yourself, be yourself. If you're going all in on yourself, wouldn't that make you selfish? Like that's a bad thing? It's not a bad thing, and it's essential if you're going to win. Now, let's be clear on one thing before you make a huge mistake. There's a difference between selfish winners and selfish losers. A selfish loser takes from everyone, doesn't know how to use what he's taken, and no one benefits, including the loser. Example, a player who becomes a distraction to the team, plays badly, and blames everyone else. Example, a business owner who pays himself well but neglects the business, pays his employees less than their value so they have no incentive to produce, blames the employees for weak performance, and the business fails. Example, parents who blow off their kids' events because they're tired, bored, or just don't want to be bothered. We're not going for that kind of selfish. We're talking about the ability to focus on yourself for all the right reasons. Selfish winners give to themselves so they can ultimately give to others. They give themselves confidence, courage, clarity. They give themselves time and space and focus. They give themselves the freedom to win. They know when to put themselves first, and they don't feel bad about that because their success fuels everyone around them. Some of the most charitable people in the world, Warren Buffett, Bill and Melinda Gates, the Walton family, are able to give billions to the causes they support because of decades of selfish hard work and commitment. Tiger Woods' entire upbringing was centered around his parents' total, and some would say selfish, focus on Tiger's career. Earl and Coltita Woods created a lifestyle for themselves and their son that allowed the family to be completely and selfishly devoted to his golf and academic education and massive success. They gave everything they had for him because they believed in the outcome. He was their one and only priority. Why is it so difficult to prioritize yourself? And why do others get so agitated when you do? When you're doing the things everyone approves of, eating, sleeping, exercising, socializing, meditating, no one would call you selfish. They can relate to those things because they're, you know, normal. But start doing things no one else is doing, things they don't approve of or understand, and you're going to hear about it. So we come up with cute ways to normalize our need to put ourselves first. The bucket list. The man cave. Me time. Girls' night out. Anything to avoid calling it what it really is. Time and space that is all about you. I'm talking to everyone who says, "I have no time for myself." Yes, you do. You've just chosen to spend it on something else. You can't get to the gym. You can't start that new project. You can't take your career to the next level. You can't spend a day doing absolutely nothing. Why? "I have no time for myself. I have too much to do. I made a promise to someone. I can't say no." Fact, you can't help all of those other people until you can first help yourself. You must get comfortable with that. You can't create your own wins without prioritizing your own goals and dreams. It's not selfish to use that no list and the IDGAF muscle we talked about in our discussion on balance. It's crucial to your success. Selfishness allows you to limit who gets into your inner circle. When you're prioritizing your time and energy, you're going to have to make tough choices about who to include in those priorities. Your family? Your friends? People who want to tell you what's best for you? People who tell you what you want to hear? If you're surrounded by others who keep reminding you they never see you, you're too busy, you need to relax, it's probably because You have too many friends and not enough allies. Allies understand what you need and what you're fighting for, and you know without a doubt they'll fight with you. Friends sometimes feel threatened by your success. Allies understand that your success doesn't detract from theirs. But selfishness comes with serious responsibility. If you're going to put yourself first, there has to be an outcome and result that will make it all worthwhile. Did you win? Did your selfishness allow you to create something positive? Did it move you further along to where you need to be? Did it benefit you in a way that made you feel good about your decision, even if no one else agreed with you? Are you willing to pay the price for that? Part of that price, perhaps the most significant part, is embracing the reality that you'll often make decisions and take actions that will make other people unhappy. And eventually, you'll learn not to care. That's how you distance yourself from everything and everyone who stands between you and winning. You learn to separate. But separation isn't just about moving away from others. It's about moving away from yourself, changing your own limiting beliefs and habits, your own insecurities and fears, and creating new expectations and values. It's about putting new demands on yourself and shutting out the noise that wants to prevent you from acting on them. Separation is about creating new levels in everything you do, from your philosophies and strategies to your mental approach to excellence. You don't need to be as good as everyone else. You need to be better. Separation is power. Power over your decisions. Power to move from where you are to where you want to be. Power to stop living a story that someone else has written for you. Power to elevate yourself. Separation is also freedom. When you've earned the ability to move away from average and typical and normal, you've also earned the right to laugh when someone tells you to stay in your lane. You have no lane. The whole road is open, and it all belongs to you. You're free to decide, act, choose. Separation is all about you and what you really want and need. It's that moment before you do something new and bold and terrifying, when it would be so easy to go back to safety, but you know what that safety will cost you. So you take the leap, knowing you can't stay where you are any longer. It's not easy, and it won't be guilt-free. If you've ever had to break away from your family or friends, if you've left your team to join another team, if you've ever gone against tradition or custom, you already know this. Others won't like it, and they'll let you know. You'll have to brace yourself for the storm that goes along with disappointing people who feel they should have a voice in all your decisions. You'll have to decide whether you need the outcome more than you need their approval. So when they say, "Are you crazy?" you must be prepared to say, "Yes, yes I am, thank you." Because if you're committed to winning, if you're determined to achieve greatness, you gotta have some crazy in you. You need to have a vision and dream that others can't even comprehend, and you have to be okay with that. Your results will explain everything. I know mine did. I'm the youngest son of Indian parents who brought our family to the United States when I was 4. Both of my parents worked in the medical field, and I was raised to understand that I had 2 choices for a career. I could be a doctor, or I could be a doctor. I chose neither. I wanted to work with professional athletes. "You're going to what?" my parents grieved. "I'm going to work with professional athletes." But to make them happy, because I genuinely wanted to make them happy, I just didn't want to be a doctor, I agreed to apply to medical school, and I prayed I wouldn't get in. I got in, which led to one of the most difficult, selfish moments of my life, telling my parents I wasn't going to medical school and wasn't going to be a doctor. To say that they were disappointed would be a wild understatement, even though I went on to get my master's degree in exercise science and managed to have a decent career doing exactly what I said I would do, work with professional athletes. But I was blessed with parents who loved and supported me even though they disagreed with my decision. Although, Even after all my success with MJ and Kobe and Wade and others, they'd still casually mention the upside of a real job with benefits and a 401k. Was I selfish? I'll let you decide. I made a choice for myself, separated from my family's expectations, and devoted my life to the results. I hope you have the opportunity to be just as selfish someday. Most of what I've done in my career has been about separation. When I started training MJ in 1989, it was rare for trainers to work directly with pro athletes. Trainers typically worked for the teams, which is how they got access to the players. But MJ wanted separation from the Bulls' standard training procedures, which was why he hired me. He wanted a program developed for his unique needs. So when the team tried to tell me how to train him, I was polite but kept my distance. And I realized that to be effective for my client and all the clients who'd follow, I'd need to remain that way. To this day, I've never been employed by a team. I consult for teams, I collaborate with teams, but my work has always been for the individual athlete. I need that defined separation to do my job effectively. But separation doesn't mean you cut all ties and refuse to cooperate. Collaboration and cooperation are essential in my business, and probably in yours too. I've worked with many corporate groups who struggle with a "fuck those guys" attitude within the business, where different teams and departments wage war on each other's procedures and results. Some believe it creates a healthy competitive environment and a badass mentality that drives people to raise the bar on their performance. But if you've ever worked in such a culture, you know it rarely turns out that way. For me to be effective in my business, I need to know that everyone involved with my client is on the same page, and they need to know that as well. That means respectful communication with team personnel, from the president and GM to the training staff and other professionals involved in our shared outcome. You need him to come in at this weight? You want to address these issues in his game? How do you plan to use him this season? I got it. We'll keep in touch. I'm always open and cooperative, which has earned me tremendous trust from teams who are customarily wary of outsiders. I also separate when it comes to talking about my clients' progress and workouts. I rarely post video or pictures of my work with athletes, and I rarely talk about what we're doing. I know it's standard now for trainers to use social media to show off their clients, not only in the gym, but in the clubs, on the golf courses, at the pool, on vacation. I go the other way. Here's the extent of my social media as it relates to my athletes. If you're relevant to my client, immediate family, agent, team personnel, health professional, and you have his or her permission, I'm happy to send you video and pictures. You have full access to whatever we're doing. Or if my clients want to post our work in their social media, or they ask me to post something, that's up to them. Otherwise, I need to keep our work separate from the entertainment and media aspect of the business and protect my clients from people who don't need to be in their business. One of the reasons I'm hired to work with corporate leaders and business owners and celebrities is because I value privacy and discretion. I won't talk to the media about what we're doing. I'm not going to screenshot their texts to post on social media. I don't walk into meetings with a camera crew following me around. Why does any of this matter? Because winning insists on being your sole priority, and that requires your full attention, your total focus, and the unlimited ability to invest in your results. To me, posting your workouts on social media isn't the kind of investment that delivers results. It gets attention, but not results. And if I do my job, if my clients do theirs, the end results speak for themselves. Other people can talk about them, and we never have to post a thing. Winning is an investment. It's the result of making selfish choices that empower your goals, separate you from limitations and insecurities, and create distance between where you've been and where you want to go. Those things don't happen accidentally. They happen when you make the decision to prioritize your ambitions and your results. It's the simple greatest investment you can make in your life, And until you're ready to commit to that, you can't even think about winning. If you know you should be getting better results and you believe you're worth the commitment to get those results, it's time to be selfish and invest. For some, that means allocating financial resources. For others, it's about education and learning. It might be a decision to change jobs or lose weight or quit smoking or work on a relationship. It can mean time or money or a shift in the way you think. That's for you to determine. But whatever that investment requires, make it, because no one is going to make it for you. How can you expect others to believe in you when you won't believe in yourself? People hesitate to invest in themselves for so many reasons. It feels egotistical. They think they're not worth it. They believe they'll fail. They think others will judge them. Maybe it's a waste of money. Can I afford to do this? They wonder. My question to them, can you afford not to? If you own a successful business that requires constant travel to multiple locations, is it really a luxury to invest in a corporate jet so you can use your time and resources more effectively? Or if you can't afford the jet, is it wasteful to join an airport lounge or fly first class so you have some room to work while you travel? If your business involves driving colleagues to look at potential real estate investments, is it flashy to invest in a nice car so your passengers are comfortable? If you're working remotely and conducting all your meetings and conferences online, shouldn't you consider spending some money on quality equipment that allows you to look and sound professional? I'm always amazed when the media report on superstar athletes who spend hundreds of thousands of dollars or more on their training and health, as if that's a crazy luxury. There's a chef and a masseuse. He's got a whole gym and a basketball court in the house. Those aren't luxuries. Those are business partners. You're talking about athletes with 8 or 9-figure incomes. You don't think they should invest 1% of that to make sure they're strong and healthy, to prolong their careers so they can keep making the kind of money that allows them to spend that kind of money? But let's be clear on this. It's not about how much money is being spent. The financial investment is worthless if you're not also investing your time and effort in the end result. How many times have you walked away from the opportunity to get better in some way? When you knew what you had to do, but didn't do it? How often have you tried reinventing yourself instead of investing in who you already are? I hear from so many young people who want to get into the training business and work with the pros. They want to know how to make that happen, like there's a secret code that will give them access. I have only one answer, regardless of whether you want to work with athletes or design skyscrapers or discover a planet. Invest in your education and your skills. There are no shortcuts. There's no fast track. Michael Jordan hired me because I presented him with a program that intrigued him, and then I backed it up with results. The years I spent investing in myself, learning, experimenting, developing a plan that would someday change the way athletes trained, allowed that to happen. It's up to you to make that happen for yourself. If your family isn't supportive, if they think you're going to fail, if they're telling you it's too hard and too much and you're making the biggest mistake of your life, you can either agree and live the life they've chosen for you, or you can take responsibility for yourself and find a way to live the life you want. You already know what I'd do. I know there are many highly successful people who didn't go to college and strongly believe you don't need college either. They'll tell you it's a waste of money. You can be successful without it. They did it, and so can you. I strongly disagree. It worked for them, that's great. But what about all the unsuccessful people who didn't go to college? Are you positive opting out of that experience will still allow you to achieve everything you want, now and in the future? What's the downside to getting the education, challenging yourself to finish something? You don't have to go to a big 4-year institution, but get something that separates you from others, that shows you've elevated beyond the pack. Winning requires a combination of street education, formal education, common sense, which is not always that common, and uncommon sense, because winning is definitely uncommon. They can take everything from you, your house, money, clothes, cars, jets, but the one thing they can't take is your education and what you've learned. And the one thing you can count on if you do indeed lose everything is that education. Invest in yourself because you're worth it. It's not selfish to want more. It's necessary to survive the hell of winning.
You talk a lot in this book about the myth of winning being a permanent condition. People win and they consider themselves as winners. But the truth, you say, is that you win and you go straight back down to the bottom to have to repeat. You win, you go back down to hell. You win, you go back down to hell. And you have a great analogy in this book about the bus that takes you to the victory parade is still waiting for you after the parade, but now the sign on the front of the bus says hell. Talk about that experience and what your clients have gone through on that never-ending journey back down to the bottom before they can go back up to the top.
How can you get stronger? How can you be more resilient? How you can come back to win again? You have to go back to hell because that's where it's going to make you stronger. That's where you understand what winning is all about, the things you had to overcome. Are you willing to overcome them again? Because once you've won once, in order to win again, you can't come back the same. So you have to take that trip back to hell where things started so you can understand it, so you can understand that feeling, so you can see it, so you can think about it. It's a trip that goes back and forth. And too many times, the reason you don't win again is you're not willing to take that trip back. True champions, true winners that win over and over again, they know they have to take that trip. They actually look forward to it because that taste of winning is so great. But the only way they can taste it again is to take that trip back to hell.
As you have said many times, the road to paradise starts in hell.
Number one, winning takes you to hell, and if you quit, that's where you'll stay.
Late one night in 2007, Kobe Bryant called Michael Jordan for advice. His knees were killing him, he said. He'd already played 10 seasons in the league and believed he could play 10 more, but he wasn't sure how much longer he could withstand the physical toll. He didn't know how much more those knees could give him. MJ understood. "Call Grover," he said. "He'll take care of you." He was already retired, and after 15 years with me, he was more than happy to see me showing up at someone else's door at 5 a.m. He shared with Kobe some of what we'd done together and why he thought I was the answer Kobe was looking for. "He's the biggest asshole you'll ever meet," said MJ, "but he knows his stuff." You really cannot ask for a better compliment from Michael Jordan. Kobe had already won championships in 2000, 2001, and 2002, and was already established as one of the best to ever play the game. But the team had fallen from dynasty to disaster. Shaquille O'Neal was unhappy and demanding a trade, which ultimately sent him to Miami. Coach Phil Jackson left just ahead of being fired and wrote a book that was highly critical of Kobe. The team became mired in a long, painful rebuilding. And now Kobe was faced with the very real and uncomfortable possibility that three rings would be it for him. By 2007, it had been 5 years since the last championship, and winning was no longer taking Kobe's calls. He could have quit, taken his three rings and said, "Good enough." He could have given in to his deteriorating knees, played less, and slowly wound down the clock on his career. Instead, he called me. I cherish being the last call someone makes when nothing else is working. That's winning to me. The first time I put him through a workout, he looked at me after an hour, dripping with sweat, and asked, "What we got left?" I told him. The road to paradise starts in hell. Kobe had been to paradise, and he'd lived through hell, and he had no problem going back and forth between the two. Our work together wasn't easy, and he didn't ask for it to be easy. We had to change his body without changing his game, and he understood that everything we did would be new and different for him, from his exercises and training regimen to his sleep schedule and diet. Everyone who worked with him, from the team staff to other elite practitioners, all knew the challenge. We were going to a new level. Winning only gives you another win if you fight for it, with greater obsession than you fought for it the first time. The work we did definitely qualified as hell. Not because it was brutally long or unnecessarily punishing, I don't believe in that, but because we had a serious goal that required serious detail. Other teammates and players in the off-season saw what we were doing and asked to join. They never came back a second time. For example, I'd have him hold a deep lunge position, with his back leg as straight as possible and the knee as close to the ground as possible without touching it, while practicing perfect shooting form with a basketball, for 5 minutes, on each leg. Try it. You'll hear Winning laughing somewhere in the distance. Sometimes, I would make a space 16 feet wide, 15 feet long, and mark off an area that replicated the NBA paint. Our workouts were done in that small space. I'd have him pivot, turn, jump, stop, go, in every direction and at every speed, with and without a ball. Then I'd ask him what movements made him feel pain. I needed to know if he felt discomfort right away, after two or three steps, when he stopped, started, jumped, or landed. Every detail. We'd identify it, address it, and work to make that area pain-free. Then we'd move on to another movement and work to make that pain-free as well, and so on, every day. He never hesitated, never skipped a workout, never backed away from a difficult challenge. When people talk of Kobe's greatness, they often say, he put in the work. True, but they're missing the point. Players like MJ and Kobe didn't just work. They constantly and consistently elevated the work, because to get out of hell, you have to elevate everything. They never stayed with what got them there. They were always adding pieces that would take them higher. They understood that if you keep doing the same thing, you're going to get the same results. So to get better, they had to put in new work, different work. If you don't evolve, if you don't find ways to challenge yourself, you're a BlackBerry in a world of iPhones. Everyone else keeps improving, and you're still running the old tired software. Kobe and I shared the same obsessions, prolonging his career, bringing him back to full strength, not just as good as he was, but better than ever, and of course, winning. By 2009, Kobe had his next win, and another in 2010. A reporter asked him during the 2009 finals how he was feeling. "I feel great," he said. "This is the best I've felt this late in the season my whole career." A win for me, to see him healthy, strong, and back in Winning's elite club. Welcome back to paradise. But the road to paradise is a two-way street, and just as quickly as you travel to the top, you can slide right back down. In fact, you can pretty much count on it. Winning doesn't let you hang around. It meets you at the parade, cheers the loudest when you get the trophy, and then escorts you out to the parking lot where the bus that brought you has a new sign with its next destination, hell. It would be 10 years before the Lakers returned to the finals again. People think of winning as this gorgeous, magnificent triumph that solves everything. And it does, for a moment. But stay in that moment too long, and winning will make sure you never have that moment again. It's a never-ending cycle, not a one-way trip. You want to win? Start at the bottom and work your way up. Congrats, you won. You want to feel that way again? Go back to the bottom and work your way up. Congrats, you won. You want to feel that way again? Go back to the bottom and, right, you get it. And even when you get to the top, winning expects you to carry a piece of hell with you so you never forget where you came from, And never forget, you can be sent back there at any moment. Winning is a painkiller for the side effects of hell. The crushing mental and physical pressure, the ruined relationships, the judgmental friends, the long hours, the relentless work, they can all be alleviated by success. Everything you want for yourself, satisfaction, pride, money, fame, glory, security, can all be yours with a powerful and sustained dose of winning. But here's the message on the warning label. Winning is a drug that requires a more powerful dose every time you take it. With every win, you learn more, you experience more, you know what can go wrong, and you know how you have to prepare for the return trip to the top. So that dosage has to steadily become more potent to work. You can't just take it in small amounts. You have to be addicted. MJ understood this better than most, as well as the essential return to hell. It's one of the things that made him great. Early in his career, he knew the hell of being physically beaten on the court by the Detroit Pistons. He knew the hell of building up his body until he was so strong he no longer had to take the abuse. He was in the league 7 seasons, yes, 7, before finally getting to paradise for the first of his 6 dances with winning. Then, back to hell. His father was murdered. The media and public scrutiny of Michael's life were out of control. And in 1993, he decided to walk away from the NBA to chase another dream. He wanted to play baseball. For 2 seasons, he played in 127 minor league games, rode minor league buses, and was working his way up to the majors when MLB players went on strike in 1994 and 95. He was asked to cross the picket line and continue playing. He refused and decided it was time to go back to his first love, basketball. He wanted to win again. When he returned to the NBA mid-season in 1995, we had 2 months to get him ready for the playoffs. Baseball had conditioned his body to move and perform in an entirely different way, and we had a relatively short period of time to reestablish his basketball body. It wasn't enough. The Bulls lost to the Orlando Magic in the 1995 playoffs, and many believed that the real MJ was done. You can't take off 2 years and return the same way, they said. It's over. Show me, said winning. Watch me, said MJ. On the night the Bulls lost to the Magic, we sat in the darkened arena after everyone had left. There wasn't a lot to say, but the silence said it all, and when he was finally ready to go, I figured it was the last time I'd see him for a while. He usually took time off at the end of the season before we started training again. Call me when you're ready, I said. Let me know when you want me to see you. I'm ready, he answered. I'll see you tomorrow. Time to get out of hell. It was a trip he'd made so many times at the start of every season. He understood nothing was promised. There were no guarantees he'd be as good or better than the season before. Everything he did, all the success, he worked for it and earned it. So as one season ended and the next approached, he knew what to expect and what to demand of himself. He didn't fear the annual hell that awaited, because every trip back made him tougher, stronger, more resilient. That was his power. Your first trip to hell is terrifying. By the second or third visit, you know what to expect, what has to be done. Resilience isn't built in your comfort zone. It's built in hell. And every time you go back, you're a little harder, rougher, less emotional, more scarred. After you've made the journey repeatedly for years and decades, you barely feel the heat. But his teammates did, as they faced an even fiercer MJ when they all returned the following season for the start of another run at greatness that began with the legendary 72-10 season and ended with 3 more rings. Everyone would come in to practice happy and relaxed, until hell walked through that door, disguised as Michael Jordan. Demanding, intimidating, cruel, driven beyond measure. And if you had a problem with that, as he said in The Last Dance, you never won anything. His teammates will tell you without hesitation that he was indeed hell to play with. But he took every one of them to paradise. Athletes and celebrities, even some CEOs and business moguls, experience the journey in public. Most people don't. That endless ride between paradise and hell happens in private, where no one knows or understands what you're dealing with. Everyone is going through something you know nothing about. Pressure, fear, mental and physical pain, self-doubt, sacrifice, the grind that never stops. It's the business owner who has to lay off half her staff just to keep the company afloat. The parents who aren't sure they can cover the bills. It's the uncertainty about whether you made the right career choice or whether your relationship is worth keeping. It's looking at yourself in the mirror and wondering if you'll ever be enough. For some, it's working for a horrible boss, dealing with health issues, dealing with difficult family issues. I don't think there's a lonelier experience than looking for answers, finding none, and realizing you're at the crossroads of your life. Either you fight your way out of the hell you're in, or start accepting that you'll be there forever. Your business can have its best month ever, and on the first of the next month, you're back to zero, back to do it all over again, this time with higher expectations. And if you're the leader of that business, you have to get the entire team to keep taking that trip with you as well, and not exhale along the way. Winning waits to see what you'll do. It doesn't care about being fair, doesn't care about your talent or skill or how hard you worked. It just wants you to figure it out and fight for it. If it makes you feel any better, you'll have a lot more company in hell than you will at the top. Hell is where most people stay, because as unpleasant as it may be, for many, it's easier to settle there than try to battle their way out, and everyone there can relate to each other's troubles. Weight, finances, relationships, careers. Hell is packed with folks who are struggling with the same issues. So many, in fact, that it starts to feel right. Normal. You fit right in. But you're still in hell, and without a decisive plan to escape, that's where you'll remain. For some, hell is about the hard work and endless battle to improve. But for others, hell is the chilling realization that they're stuck and will probably stay that way. People will tell you to just push through it, as if there's a one-way door to winning that swings wide open. Pushing isn't enough. It's unimaginative and predictable. You pushed, and then what? To get out of your own personal hell, you have to be able to pull, grab, reach, climb, slither, jump, dig, claw your way to freedom. Remember MJ's words in The Last Dance? I pulled people along when they didn't want to be pulled. Most people give a little push and find themselves in a revolving door that just goes around and around and around. Winning sets unreasonable goals and requires you to bear the burden of responsibility for achieving them. That means doing anything and everything possible to get out of the situation you're in and into position to win. You can pay the price of winning and succeed, or you can quit, stay where you are, and pay the price of regret. Winning will use every dirty trick in the book and make up new ones just to entertain itself to keep you in hell. It's too hard, it whispers. You'll never get there. Your parents don't believe in you. Your friends think you're crazy. Look at you. You're already a failure. Which, by no coincidence, is exactly what you were already thinking. So you stay there, waiting. Waiting to feel different. Waiting to be told what to do. Waiting for an answer that never comes. And meanwhile, the flames are getting hotter and hotter until you can't take it. You have to take action, or you burn out. But instead of being propelled by the heat, you can become frozen where you are. You have to embrace the negativity, the criticism, the cynicism of others, so you can control how that fire burns. Fire can destroy, but it can also forge new creations. The more you can withstand, and the sooner you take action, the greater your chances of getting back in the race. For some, it's all too much to deal with. They do nothing, and eventually winning gives up on them entirely and moves on. If you don't want more for yourself, that's fine. Someone else will get that win. Instead, Your hell becomes never knowing what could have been, never having more or doing more for yourself. That's the hell of complacency, the hell of average. It's quiet. There's no rage or fire, just a silent hell of nothingness. For others, hell is the result of choices. These people chose a path that looked like winning and got everything they wanted, but realized too late they hated the path they chose. That's the player who takes the big contract but ends up on a losing team. The CEO with a successful business who hates what he does, the relationship that fails because you chose the wrong partner. That's the hell of wanting and needing something different. Often, that's when winning walks away from you. I gave you an opportunity and you blew it. It may allow you back in through some other endeavor, but not that one. Sorry, we're closed. For now. Back to hell for more time to make the transition. For many, that kind of disappointment and failure is a hard stop. For the greats, it's the start of a new race. When winning took Kobe's Achilles and his dreams of a sixth and seventh ring, he had to go win something else. It wasn't enough to win the Oscar and write bestsellers and create films. He was revolutionizing girls' basketball with his daughter, Gianna, teaching her and her teammates how to win the Mamba way. While most kids that age practice for 45 minutes and then have a snack, Kobe held three-hour practices with 2.5 hours devoted just to defense. He couldn't stop finding ways to win. But not all athletes are able to transfer their competitive drive into new things to chase once their careers reach an expiration date. I'm not talking about pro athletes who have made millions and, if they've managed their money, can ride for a while on their investments and their fame. Think about Olympians, who make that endless round trip from hell to winning every 4 years, if they do everything right. They might only get there once. And then what? The rarest of Olympians, Michael Phelps or Simone Biles, for example, might have a career as a spokesperson or speaker or broadcaster. But if you're an archer or a bobsledder or a pole vaulter, what's next for that athlete? You can be